Succession number 28455, Reel 5.
John Davis. And we now start Reel 5, John Davis.
The Deb dancing let many of my country weekends were at the Strauss house, the brothers Robert and Ronnie Strauss, somewhere outside London. A grand mansion, these days, rich stockbroker people bought. They had super motor cars of that vintage, Lagondas and so on. And we went down there, and they were young girls, and we had, I think we didn't smoke much, we drank a bit. But we did a lot of canoodling and fun. We were the phase when we were looking for girls and having fun all the time. But nothing serious went on, you know, like the different culture then. Quite strict sexual behaviour. But it was very exciting. And the end of it all, there'd be supper. And the end was at like 1 o'clock in the morning at these Deb hotels. The Strand, was it the Strand that we hotel?
Yes, I think yes. That's a big one along
big
there, isn't
hotel.
It?
Mm-hmm. You'd have supper, and then quite strictly, you got parted. Off you went. The girls went with their mothers and chaperones, and away they went. And then the boys went. And so I was very broke. I don't know why, but I was. So I had to get a taxi till I was out of view, as it were, and then get into the underground or walk, like the Bayswater. So I wasn't a real Deb runner, I suppose. Might have been if I'd stayed, but I was kind of relieved by the war. I didn't want to be a stockbroker, really. The war let me out. Because in June 30, by early 39, at last, Britain decided something was going to happen. So they doubled the territorial army, the thing I was concerned with, from one battalion to two. And just because of my knowing things or being known, they offered me a commission in the 2nd Battalion. The first question was, can you afford the sword and your uniform and your mess bill and all those things? My father then had fled to Canada. They were driven out of North China. So I cabled Canada and he said, yes, go on, give me money to do all these jolly things. So I accepted a commission. 2nd Lieutenant in the 2nd Battalion, London Scottish.
That was an expensive affair.
Yes.
You one forgets that.
Buy a lot of stuff. One forgets that. I've got the sword upstairs still. You had to buy a sword. You had to buy officers' uniform. Officers, what do we call it? In front of the kilt there.
All the uniform, I expect.
Yeah, the uniform's quite different.
Yes.
You went to a special tailor's to have your uniform made, and your shirts, and your Sam Brown, and your camping kit, and your canvas wash basin, and all that. It bought every last thing to be an officer. And then you went to weekly mess. Could you pay the mess bill and buy drinks? So that one of the entrees was, can you afford this business of being an officer? So I qualified there. I was quite a good soldier, I believe, and I felt quite confident about all that. Didn't have any doubts.
By then, had the war started?
No, it's June. June 39. June the 6th, I've got a mug in the bar there. It says on appointment when I became an officer. 6th of June 1939. That's when I was commissioned. A lot of us were. And I was about to go to a levee to the palace, which all officers had to do. But the war was too close by then, and they cancelled all levees, as they cancelled Deb dances and all these social things. So the sort of class and social events were scrubbed early summer of 39. And one of them was officers being presented to the king by then George VI. On my sword is George VI, and your own initials, showing when you were commissioned. So it was... great thrill for me, of course. One camp I was a private soldier, and the same property in Hampshire, New Forest. The next camp I was a young officer. Just like that, you went from a private to a second lieutenant in one go. And you learned on the job, as it were, how to be an officer. Weekly parades and how to do this, that and the other.
Probably, but do you think it's an advantage having been in the ranks? When you are an officer, the fact that you've been, you know, an ordinary soldier.
Yes, I do. Yes, rather. Yes, indeed. and all those school OTC, Tinsley Volunteers, London Scottish Private, all that helped me to understand the hierarchy of the military, the way it worked, and all the time stiffening us up, both at all these events, were rail soldiers, regulars. In Tinsin, with some garrison men in OTC, we had some Baths came and instructed us now and then. And of course, in the territorials, we had several Gordon Highlanders, who are PTIs, permanent training instructors, who taught us soldiering, mostly NCOs.
So the regulars were important?
Yes, and the Gordon Highlanders were our parent regiment, we called it that. We were the territorial branch of the Gordon Highlanders, yes.
So what would your situation have been when war started on the 3rd of September?
Yes, I was at home in this Bayswater flat with my mother. My sister had gone off to Canada by then. Much of the family started to leak away to Canada. And this my mother and I were in this flat. Phone call came through from the battalion headquarters on the Thames somewhere. And we were being mobilised. Present yourself at the battalion headquarters as soon as you can, with all your uniform and all your camping kit and every last thing, as soon as you can. So I got into my uniform, got a taxi to the Bayswater Mews, and there was a great green palliasse there with all my bedding in it, my camp bed, my washing basin and all that stuff on the cobbles, and all the things I could think of collected into the taxi, and off I went. Joined... We were mobilised formally, and within I think the very same night we were down at the East India docks manning the docks ready for invasion, and we heard Chamberlain's famous speech in the East India docks with war being declared. We were already in uniform, we had ammunition. Old-fashioned, we wore kilts, we were not in battle dress, we had no tin helmets, we were just in parade uniform. The soldiers all wore kilts, so there was no battle dress yet out, and but we were ready for action. And we were supposed to man the East India docks, and the first thing that we did was to take over a German boat which was moored there on its way around the world in the East India docks. Because on the hill at the back it was flattened, ready for taking guns, although it was a civilian freight ship. So we took that over, and the police came and took the captain off and took him away to internment.
So things started happening quickly.
Did start to notice then. Yes, things were more serious.
What did you expect, you know, with the when war started after Chamberlain's announcement? Did you expect things to happen immediately?
No, we didn't. We were still pretty oblivious. The press and the general state of calmness and acceptance wasn't permeated. We didn't feel under threat yet. No aeroplanes bombing or anything that started like that yet in the summer of 39. So we had our mess nights and we had our duty patrols to do. We slept hard. I slept in a huge great warehouse in my camp bed, vast warehouse, and I was at one corner of it and there were some other officers elsewhere. This great warehouse, one or two stories up in the docks, but my batman from somewhere or other appeared with my morning mug of tea and gave it to me in my camp bed. So it was funny war. So we did man places ready to shoot. We had bullets, and I would go inspect the outpost as a young lieutenant, second lieutenant, still kilted, no tin hats, none of that stuff yet. Sam Brown, the pistol on my Sam Brown belt, that's my armament was that. And very amateurish, I suppose, but we were meaning to do our best. And the thing I noticed most strongly, I've written it somewhere in my book, I suppose, that as the winter came on, all the dockers and all the London East Enders, all English people, were very good to us. Great camaraderie was going on at all levels of society, soldiers and dockers and navvies and all sorts. We had asked out to lunch here and there, and all sorts of good things going on like that. And we were minded by the civilian population of the East End very well. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm. The East Enders, of course, have got a very good reputation, yes, haven't they, for hospitality? And you found that, didn't
I
you?
I found that straight away. I was very surprised, coming from this rather sheltered situation in Yule and then in Bayswater, Mews Flat, Stock Exchange, Dead Dancing, to meet this other world.
Yes, it must have been a great contrast, because there was great poverty there then, wasn't
there? Yes,
there
was. Yes, yes.
And of course, later the bombing.
Later came the bombing. The bombing had started. We sneaked up to the West End every now and then when we could. Yes, two or three of us went on a binge to the West End and Piccadilly and Fun and Games nightclubs and back to the docks, of course. At one stage, the bombing had started. And I was going to a nightclub in Jermyn Street, which had just been hit. And everybody had been killed. I forget the name of it. It wasn't the Royal in Regent Street. Palais, what is it called? Palais Royal. It had a name or other, and it was a downstairs under Jermyn Street, a nightclub. We were going to dance in it. Great fun. And it had just been hit, and everyone had killed, so we got the shock that things were getting serious then. We were at risk. Didn't notice much until then. Somehow everything was taken for granted so much. Partly being just 20, I wasn't yet 21.
And also the phony war, this
was. The phony war, exactly. Yes, nothing happening on the mainland.
Yes.
Soldiers were over there, and nothing going on much for a long time. Exactly. Yes, yes.
Yes. So when things did hot up, were you still at the docks? Because there was a lot of bombing there, wasn't there, during the Blitz of 1940?
We had so many postings. We moved out from the docks before it was being bombed, and we went to Pinner, that's in Dockland. We went to somewhere in Middlesex, and I was a billeting officer. Charles Burt and I were two billeting officers, and we were sent ahead to find billets, and we found billets for all the soldiers and for the officers, and we billeted ourselves in the house. Grand house of one Mrs. Rich. We had two real beds with mattresses and sheets and all that, instead of our camp beds. And the mess was the golf club, where the officers used to have their meals, and the soldiers were in other billets all around there.
You did all right.
It did all right. Yes.
Yes. What was the situation with billeting? You know, did you have the powers to actually demand accommodation?
We did, yes. I don't quite know how. We had our quartermaster with us, who was a regular soldier, risen from the ranks. He'd been a sergeant major and so on. He was now a full lieutenant, quartermaster. Every battalion has a quartermaster who looks after all the supplies. Bill Reith, he came round with us and laid on the law. He knew the law and he spoke in his deep Scottish accent and had papers and somehow did the stuff the youngsters didn't understand. And Billet grabbed it, commandeered it, yes. We had those powers already. 1940, I suppose. Before Christmas of 39 it was. Yes, we'd gone from Dockland and started moving billet after billet all over the place. And I had my 21st in this place in Middlesex. Rixmansworth, I don't know what his name is. We were at a mess there, and having a mess, and the port was passed round, and I asked the sergeant, Mess Sergeant, to send it round a second time, and they said, what's this? And I said, it's my 21st.
How about the invasion scare? Were you involved with sort of defence matters then?
Yes. Yes, we went all over the place. In Cambridgeshire, we thought we were being dropped on by parachutes. And then later we came down to this very place, Milford-on-Sea, where I was billeted in a big hotel here called Westover, and I was Later, I was a carrier platoon officer. Yes, in Cambridgeshire, the Bren carriers, which was a captain's job. So I got promoted. And when I came down here, I remained a captain, and we took over from the Royal Fusiliers, the Westover Hotel, to guard this piece of the coast running from Hurst Castle, where there's a battery of Akak, all the way about 3 miles down the beach there, through to a big school there called Hordle School. And we had pillboxes, and we were there about 4:30 every morning with weapons oiled and ready, and I would go from pillbox to pillbox here, and he was ready and organised. And then we stood down about 6:30 thinking invasion time was over.
Did you... was an invasion seriously expected?
Yes, it really was. We expected to see things come round the Isle of Wight at any moment, every day. We really did. It seems absurd now. Nobody understands why Hitler didn't do it. I think he turned to Russia. He did other things, but he didn't invade, but he could well have done. By then we had proper kit. We had battle dress, steel helmets.
But could you have repelled, do you think, a really strong invasion force?
No, I doubt it. I think they would have massacred us. We had a reserve battalion inland a bit. And we couldn't... The Germans, we watched... we had films of the German army. They were very efficient. They looked so much better than we knew about soldiering.
What were your instructions, you know, if this force did appear? What were you, as a young officer, expected to do?
First of all, we put scaffolding in the sea. It was summertime, and also it was a great fun putting scaffolding into the sea, which at high tide would scrape the bottom of boats trying to land, just off our very beach here, below me. And my pillbox is still down here, the original pillbox. And we were to shoot to kill, stop them, call in the artillery, just stop them. We were very primitive. We weren't really well prepared, but we were prepared to die and stop them. And up the road, my dear friend Arthur Thompson took over Hordle School with his B company. I was here with C Company. I had about 100 soldiers in that hotel there, 3 or 4 officers. And Arthur was up there. He was killed later in France by a sniper, Arthur Thompson. I was best man at his wedding. He had soldiers at Hordle School along the beach, and then we had more in Highcliff. So all of this beach was manned and ready for fighting, yes. So we... then it eased off, of course. Hitler turned away, didn't seem like being invading. And
is this when you were under your CO, Gordon Maxwell?
It is. Gordon Maxwell is the CO, and he was at New Milton, which is 4 miles from here, the battalion headquarters, a big school there called Great Ballard, with the headquarters company. And during that time, I had to go to headquarters to take a fellow captain who was a First War man to Winchester jail, of all darn things, to escort him to jail because he'd done some check, he got into trouble with money, and was cashiered and sent to Winchester jail. And I was quite a young man, in my early 20s. I had to escort this First War man who seemed ancient to me, in his 40s, I suppose, more maybe, in a truck to Winchester jail and hand him over and get a receipt, which shook me greatly. Splendid man. And I drove him to his house somewhere in Hampshire here, to his wife, for him to change out of uniform. And I was terrified that while he was upstairs he'd climb out the back and escape, but he didn't. So weird things that went on.
I believe you met Queen Elizabeth once, didn't you? I read in your book.
Yes.
Could you tell me about that?
Yes, we were at Brighton then. We were posted all about. We were also guarding Brighton coast at one time. Billeted in Rodine School. The whole blinking battalion filled up Rodine School. And we were guarding all of Brighton and that area. And we were in a hotel there, Rottingdean Hotel, the officers. And the Queen came to him. She was a colonel. Queen Elizabeth was an honorary colonel of our regiment. She was Mrs. King George VI, she was that Queen Escort, and she came down to inspect us in the summer, and I was still the Wren Terrier officer, and we had the South Downs behind us at Brighton, and I suggested to go for a ride in one of my carriers, and it was accepted, and she came up to the Downs and got into my Wren Carrier. There's a picture of me handing her into it with Gordon Maxwell just behind, and bounced around the South Downs with the Queen in the back.
What was she like? You know,
she was very good fun. It
was
a great, great picture, but they had the mess with her in the middle after lunch. And we had some rickety old furniture in this hotel. And she sat in an armchair which only had three legs, which had a caster missing or something like that. And there was an officer standing holding it up. And he said, "You all right there?" Or something. He said, "He's holding the chair up, ma'am." So she was good fun. Yes, rather. And she came in a great Rolls Royce with a guard and so on. But I had my loaded pistol when I took her on into the Wren Carrier, and nobody else was armed except myself at that point, because we were guarding her. And away she went back to London, had lunch and inspected the soldiers and inspected the officers, and off she went. She seemed a very good soldier. We were very pleased to honour her, you know, to be honoured by her. Yes, yes, yes.
So you finished your war in Britain, did you?
I was posted, this ear of mine started to be noticed. Well, I was posted to North Africa, where my dear immediate friends, Arthur Thompson and Leslie Syme and other colleagues of mine, young officers, were all posted to North Africa, and I should have gone. But the MO looked at my ear and said, "No, you're category B, and you can't go." So I was sent to Aberdeen, which is the barracks of the Gordon Highlanders, and there we trained soldiers. We took slummy, awful creatures in from Glasgow and elsewhere, scales on their legs, thin, hungry, and in about 8 weeks put them out as body, strong soldiers, running and shooting and wearing everything, trained soldiers there, Brigadon Barracks, which was blitzed, by the way, it was bombed in the war, and I was in it when it was hit, and it killed a lot of soldiers. Hit Brigadon Barracks. There were two-story granite buildings. Dr. Storr came down and killed them. They were all in bed at night. I was a duty officer running around, and the great colonel there, McGregor, who was a ranker in the First War, became colonel, grand chap.
Yes, these poor boys, you know, you were really getting a view of the other side of British society, weren't you?
It was. They were real slum Glaswegians of the worst sort, totally illiterate and starved and, you know, really poorly. That generation was the case, 1941 and 1942, yep. And we were turning them into fighting soldiers. We did, and they looked smart. They went out to town looking grand, you know, proud of themselves. So I did a several months there, and then I went to Ayr, and not to Ayr, I went to Meldrum, north of Aberdeen, where they make that 69 whiskey, and was billeted there for a while. And then I was called back to the headquarters in Ayr Racecourse and said, "You're going to do some overseas service now. Go to Germany and mine displaced persons." So after the battle, after all the campaigns, there were all these people pouring in from prison camps, lost people, orphaned, unknown, didn't know what earth they were doing, came to camps.
Yes, I think I'm going to ask you about that on the next tape.
Oh, right.
So this is the end of Reel 5, John Davis.
Yes.
And I'll give you a little break. I think your voice needs it.